flanked by three aides, and Roosevelt, flanked by his two favorite reporters, Richard Harding Davis of the Herald and Edward Marshall of the Journal. Both men had reported favorably, in the past, on his exploits as police commissioner. He now relied on them to glorify him as a warrior, and cultivated them accordingly. Stephen Crane of the World, whom Roosevelt did not like at all, was left to bring up the extreme rear. Half a mile west and 200 or 300 feet lower on the Valley Road, General Young's infantrymen were marching in a roughly parallel direction, but the intervening vegetation was so dense that they could be neither seen nor heard, save for a bugle call now and then. After about an hour's march, Captain Capron came back through the trees to announce that his scout had discovered the body of the dead guerrilla. Wood turned to Roosevelt. "Pass the word back to keep silence in the ranks." Then he disappeared up the trail with Capron, leaving Roosevelt and Marshall to discuss coolly and disobediently a lunch they had once had with William Randolph Hearst at the Astor House. Meanwhile, the men relaxed on the ground, chewing blades of grass and fanning the stagnant air with their hats. As Roosevelt talked, his glance fell on some barbed wire curling from a fence to the left of the trail. He reached for a strand, gazed at it with the expert eye of a ranchman, and started, "My God! This wire has been cut today!" "What makes you think so?" asked Marshall. "The end is bright, and there's been enough dew even since sunrise to put a light rust on it." Just as he spoke, the regimental surgeon came up from behind, riding noisily on a mule. Roosevelt leaped to silence him. Then, as the Rough Riders held their breath, a terrifying sound came winging through the bushes. Marshall, who was to hear the sound endlessly repeated that day, and would find himself paralyzed from the waist down by it, described it as a zzzzoo, rising to a shrill crescendo, then sinking with a moan on the ooh. It was the trajectory of a high-speed Mauser bullet, standard equipment with Spanish snipers. Blood-curdling though the sound was, with the concomitant ping and zip of perforated leaves enabling a man to judge its approach velocity and the utter impossibility of getting out of the way in time, the worst moment came when the zzzoo was followed by a loud chook, indicating that the bullet had hit flesh. The force of impact on a man's outstretched arm was enough to spin him around before he thumped in a flaccid heap on the ground. Often as not, a man so struck would rise again after a few minutes, none the worse but for a tiny, cauterized hole. The flaccidity was merely a shock reaction, common to all Mauser victims. But other men lay where they dropped. The first soldier to be killed by these first rifle shots of the Spanish-American War was Sergeant Hamilton Fish, who fell at the feet of Captain Capron. Then another Mauser took Capron in the heart. So much for their frames of steel. 6 more Rough Riders died in the hail of fire that followed, the most intense, according to one scholarly major, in the history of warfare. 34 men were wounded, many of them repeatedly. Private Isbell, of L Troop, was hit 3 times in the neck, twice in the left hand, once in the right hand, and finally in the head. Roosevelt, literally jumping up and down with excitement as he awaited Wood's order to deploy, made no effort to run for cover. Somehow the bullets missed him, although one did smack into a tree inches from his cheek and filled his eyes with splinters of bark. Wood, whose casual confidence under fire earned him the nickname Old Icebox, asked Roosevelt to take 3 troops into the jungle on the right, while 3 other troops fanned out on the left. Marshall remained behind, idly curious to see how the lieutenant colonel comported himself in battle. Perhaps a dozen of Roosevelt's men had passed into the thicket before he did. Then he stepped across the wire himself, and from that instant became the most magnificent soldier I have ever seen. It was as if that barbed wire strand had formed a dividing line in his life, and that when he stepped across it, he left behind him in the bridle path all those unadmirable and conspicuous traits which have so often caused him to be justly criticized in civic life, and found on the other side of it, in that Cuban thicket, the coolness, the calm judgment, the towering heroism, which made him, perhaps, the most admired and best beloved of all Americans in Cuba. Where the shots were coming from, even Roosevelt, with his acute hearing, could not tell. He knew only that the snipers were distant and highly placed. Evidently the Spanish, trained in guerrilla tactics by 3 years of fighting the Cubans, knew exactly where the trail was. But how, since the Rough Riders were camouflaged by trees, did they know where to shoot? Much later it transpired that the strange cooing and cuckoo calls he had heard earlier came from lookouts posted in the jungle, tracking the regiment's progress to the point of ambush. All at once the trees parted, and Roosevelt found himself gazing out over the Santiago Road to a razorback ridge on the opposite side of the valley. General Young's men were stationed below, under heavy fire themselves by the sound of it. But thanks to the enemy's smokeless powder, he still could not see the entrenchments. It took a newspaperman to point the Spaniards out to him.
"There they are, Colonel," cried Richard Harding Davis. "Look over there. I can see their hats near that glade."
Roosevelt focused his binoculars, estimated the range, and ordered his troops to rapid fire. Davis joined in with a carbine he had picked up somewhere. The woods, according to Stephen Crane, became aglow with fighting. In 3 minutes, 9 men were lying on their backs in Roosevelt's immediate vicinity. But the Rough Riders fired back with such blistering accuracy that the Spaniards soon quit their trenches and took refuge in the jungle farther up the ridge. Unable to pursue them for an impenetrable wall of vines, Roosevelt ordered his men back to the main trail, where the Mausers were whining as viciously as ever. Although he did not fully realize it, he had succeeded brilliantly in his first military skirmish. By engaging and driving back the enemy's foremost flank, he had exposed troops holding the top of the ridge to crossfire from the entire line of Rough Riders and frontal attack from General Young's regulars. The way was now open for a final grand charge by all the American forces, with Roosevelt commanding the extreme left, Wood commanding the center, and the regulars on the right advancing under orders from General Wheeler himself. About 900 men broke out into the open and ran up the valley, Roosevelt stopping to pick up 3 Mauser cartridges as souvenirs for his children, their rifle cracks drowned in the booming of 4 Hotchkiss mountain guns. Like ants shaken from a biscuit, some 1,500 Spaniards leaped from their rock forts along the ridge and scattered in the direction of Santiago.
"We've got the damn Yankees on the run!" roared Fighting Joe.
By 9:20 a.m., the Battle of Las Guasimas was over. An exhausted major looked at his watch, shook it incredulously, and held it up to his ear. He was sure that the engagement had lasted at least 6 hours. Actually, it had been only 2. A few minutes later, the 1st of General Lawton's infantrymen arrived and found that their services were not needed. Lawton was furious. According to one report, he accused Wheeler of deliberately stealing a march on him.
"I was given command of the advance, and I want you to know that I propose to keep it, by God, even if I have to put a guard to keep other troops in the rear."
Fighting Joe was philosophical, for he received in due time the congratulations of General Shafter. As long as that leisurely officer remained on board the Seguranza, Wheeler, not Lawton, was the senior general ashore, and he could issue and interpret orders as he saw fit. For the moment, he was satisfied. He had driven back the Spaniards. His bandy-legged cavalry had outmarched the infantry. Best of all, he had avenged Appomattox. Such triumph was cheap at a cost of 16 Americans dead and 52 wounded, to Spain's figures of 10 and 8. Others, gazing at the sightless eyes of Hamilton Fish, or the shattered spine of Edward Marshall, writhing in agony as he dictated his dispatch to Stephen Crane, might wonder if the Battle of Las Guasimas had been really worth it. "One object at least was accomplished," wrote Leslie's correspondent Burr McIntosh, whom Roosevelt had also left behind at Siboney. The names of several men were in the newspapers before the names of several others, and a number of newspaper men, who were sure to write things in the proper spirit, were given the necessary tip. Also, the necessary flattery. Roosevelt was quick to cite Richard Harding Davis in his official report, and even tried to get the Associated Press to mention Davis's gallantry while the battle was still going on. Davis, who tended to treat friends as they treated him, responded with laudatory accounts of the battle, earning praise for Roosevelt's Rough Riders as its only apparent heroes. In Washington, there was talk of promoting Roosevelt to the rank of Brigadier General, and in New York, a coalition of independent Republicans announced that they intended to nominate him for governor in September. Whether the praise was deserved or not, Roosevelt's personal views of his role in the Las Guasimas victory were modest, and remained so always. He liked to joke about his inability to see the enemy, his difficulty running with a sword swinging between his legs, and his policy of firing at any target that was not a tree. "However, as throughout the morning I had preserved a specious aspect of wisdom,
and had commanded first one wing and then the other wing, the fight really was a capital thing for me, for practically all the men had served under my actual command, and thenceforth felt enthusiastic belief that I would lead them aright.
In his speech to the Naval War College a year before, Roosevelt had urged America to prepare for blood, sweat, and tears when war came. The Battle of Las Guasimas gave the Rough Riders ample opportunity to wallow in all three. Regimental Surgeon Bob Church looked, that evening, like a kid who had gotten his hands and arms into a bucket of thick red paint. Gouts of blood trembled on the leaves along the trail and plastered whole sheaves of grass together. Fresh blood flowed as Church snipped open Mauser holes in order to dress them. Wherever a casualty lay, the predators of Cuba collected in rings. Huge land crabs shredding corpses with their clattering claws, vultures tearing off lips and eyelids, then the eyeballs, and finally whole faces. But the most despised predators were Cubans themselves, who invariably materialized from the jungle to strip the dead of clothing, equipment, and jewelry, and rummage around for jettisoned food cans. Was it for these squat, dull-eyed peasants that the flower of America had died? Compassion, never one of Theodore Roosevelt's outstanding characteristics, was notably absent from his written accounts of Las Guasimas and its aftermath, unless the perfunctory phrase, "poor Capron and ham fish," can be counted to mean anything. His only recorded emotion is the Rough Riders buried seven of their dead next morning in a common grave darkened with the shadows of circling buzzards, was pride in its all-American variety. Indian and cowboy, miner, packer, and college athlete, the man of unknown ancestry from the lonely western plains, and the man who carried on his watch the crest of the Stuyvesants and the fishes. When Bucky O'Neill turned to him and asked, "Colonel, isn't it Whitman who says of the vultures that they pluck the eyes of princes and tear the flesh of kings?" Roosevelt answered coldly that he could not place the quotation. His duty, as he saw it, lay with those who were still standing and able to fight. Since landing in Cuba, his men had had nothing to eat or drink but hardtack, bacon, and sugarless coffee. What was left of these heavy comestibles had been dumped during their two forced marches, and due to General Shafter's maddening mismanagement of the unloading operation, still in process at Siboney, no fresh supplies were expected for several days. Soon the Rough Riders were forced to scrounge, like Cubans, in the bags of dead Spanish mules. On the morning of 26 June, Roosevelt got wind of a stockpile of beans on the beach and marched a squad of men hastily down to investigate. There were, indeed, at least 1,100 pounds of beans available, so he went into the commissary and demanded the full amount for his regiment. The commissar reached for a book of regulations and showed him that, under subsection B of section C of Article 4, or something like that, beans were available only to officers. Roosevelt had learned enough during his 6 years as civil service commissioner not to protest this attitude. He merely went outside for a moment, then returned and demanded 1,100 pounds of beans for the officers' mess. Commissar: "But your officers cannot eat 1,100 pounds of beans." Roosevelt: "You don't know what appetites my officers have." Commissar, wavering: "I'll have to send the requisition to Washington." Roosevelt: "All right, only give me the beans." Commissar: "I'm afraid they'll take it out of your salary." Roosevelt: "That will be all right, only give me the beans." So the Rough Riders got their beans, and the requisition went to Washington. Oh, what a feast we had, and how we enjoyed it! The average height among the Americans, reported a Barcelona newspaper, is 5 feet 2 inches. This is due to their living almost entirely upon vegetables as they ship all their beef out of the country, so eager are they to make money. There is no doubt that one full-grown Spaniard can defeat any three men in America. For the last 6 days of June, the Rough Riders camped in a little Eden on the westward slope of the ridge of Las Guasimas. They washed their bloody uniforms in a stream gushing out of the jungle, learned how to fry mangoes, and when tobacco ran out at a black market price of $2 a plug, how to smoke dried grass, roots, and manure. The Cubans, if useless for all else, were at least good for rum. A can of army beef, vintage 1894, according to the label, was enough to fill one's canteen, and a whole squad could get drunk on the proceeds of one Rough Rider blanket.
Fifth Corps staff, meanwhile, had solved the complicated logistical problem of getting General Shafter finally on shore and bringing him up the Camino Real in a sagging buckboard. Like all obese people, the general felt the heat badly. In addition, his gout was worse, and he had contracted a scalp condition which necessitated constant scratching by aides. Not until the morning of 30 June did he venture down from the ridge to explore the terrain still separating his forces from Santiago. The best vantage point was a hill named El Pozo, to the left of the road where it crossed the river, or, to be more precise, where the river crossed the road. Ascending this hill on the army's stoutest mule, Shafter gazed across a landscape which the Rough Riders, from their camp in the rear, already knew by heart. Dense jungle filled the basin in front of him. There were hills to the right and hills to the left, the latter crowned by a fortified village named El Canai. Another ridge of hills rose on the far side of the basin, about a mile and a half away, walling off Santiago in another basin, much wider and lower to the west. The peaks undulated enticingly, exposing whitewashed triangles of the city to view, but their steep-facing slopes, and in particular the heavy entrenchments visible all the way along the crest, made it obvious at a glance that they would be, as Garcia had warned, General Linares's last line of defense. These were the San Juan Heights, and that dominant central outcrop, crowned with a blockhouse, was San Juan Hill itself. Since the Camino Real snaked over the range slightly to the right of it, capture of the hill meant possession of the road. Shafter would then be able to mount a land siege of Santiago, while Admiral Sampson continued his siege by sea. It would be a matter of time until starvation forced the surrender of the city. If General Shafter noticed a smaller hill in front of San Juan Heights, cutting off his view of some of the road, he did not consider it worthy of inclusion in his hand-drawn map. A council of war was called in command headquarters early in the afternoon. Shafter looked ill and exhausted by his ascent of El Pozo. Obviously, being at the front did not agree with him, but he had a definite plan of campaign worked out and announced it in peremptory tones. The Fifth Corps would begin the advance upon Santiago immediately, that very evening. 8,000 enemy troops were reported to be on their way from another part of the province to supplement the 12,000 already in and around Santiago. Clearly not a moment must be lost. The divisions would move along the Camino Real under cover of dusk and spread out in the vicinity of El Pozo. While Brigadier General J.F. Kent's 1st Infantry and General Wheeler's cavalry encamped on the flanks of the hill, General Lawton's 2nd Infantry would swing right and march toward El Canai and bivouac somewhere en route. All forces would then be posed for a big battle, which would inevitably begin next morning. Sitting vast and rumpled in shirt sleeves and suspenders, his gouty foot wrapped in burlap, Shafter detailed the swift, simple maneuvers he would like to see, or at least hear about, during the day. At dawn, General Lawton would assault El Canai and take the fort there, cutting off the northern supply route to Santiago. This should take only about 3 hours. Meanwhile, the other two divisions would launch their own attack upon San Juan Hill, moving through the jungle along Camino Real and deploying as they approached the foothills. Lawton was to join them on the right as soon as he was free, and the day's action would climax in a massive onslaught on the heights, plainly inspired by the final charge at Las Guasimas. The Council of War was barely over when a staff officer rode over to Rough Rider headquarters and announced that Generals Wheeler and Young had been felled by fever. Command of the cavalry division, therefore, devolved upon Brigadier General Samuel S. Sumner and that of Young's 2nd Brigade upon Leonard Wood. "While to my intense delight," wrote Theodore Roosevelt, "I got my regiment." His long-postponed colonelcy had come just in time for the decisive engagement of the Spanish-American War. One small detail which had apparently escaped General Shafter's attention was that mobilization of some 16,000 men along a road 10 feet wide would cause certain problems, especially as he had ordered the entire Fifth Corps to start marching at 4 p.m. A violent rainstorm at 3:30 did not help matters, for it converted the Camino Real into a ditch which squished deeper under every fresh line of boots. "Darkness came and still we marched," one Rough Rider remembered. "The tropical moon rose. You could almost envy the ease with which this orange ball crossed the sky. It was all we could do to lift our muddy shoes." At last, about 8 o'clock, the dark silhouette of El Pozo loomed up through the trees and the regiment clambered halfway up its eastern slope. Leaving his men to sleep where they chose, Roosevelt strolled over the brow of the hill and found Wood establishing temporary headquarters in an abandoned sugar factory. Brigadier General and Colonel now, they gazed across at San Juan Heights and the refracted glow of Santiago's streetlights. Then they curled up in their yellow slickers on a bed of saddle blankets and went to sleep. The 1st of July, 1898, which Roosevelt ever afterward called the great day of my life, dawned to a fugato of bugles, phrase echoing phrase as reveille sounded in the various camps. The morning was Elysian, with a pink sky lightening rapidly to pale, cloudless blue. Mists filled the basin below El Pozo, evaporating quickly as the air warmed, exposing first the crowns of royal palms, then the lower green of deciduous trees and vines. Hills rippled across the horizon to east, west, and north, like a violet backdrop. As the vapor burned away, the effect to Roosevelt was of shimmering curtains rising to disclose an amphitheater for the battle. While his men got up, he walked about calmly lathering his face, reassuring the many who had woken afraid. He wore a dark blue shirt with yellow suspenders, fastened with silver leaves, and, in the apparent belief that people might otherwise mistake him for a regular, a stand-up collar emblazoned with the volunteer insignia. Breakfast was frugal, a handful of beans, the invariable slabs of fat bacon and hardtack, washed down with bitter coffee. Then the regiment fell in, along with others of Wood's brigade, to await marching orders. Four big guns of the 1st Artillery were hauled up El Pozo and wedged into position. A staff officer came by with the predictable news that General Shafter had been taken ill during the night and would have to command the battle from his cot. Roosevelt probably paid little attention. He was waiting for the first detonation of Lawton's battery. It came at 6:30, a sullen roar that rolled over the still-sleeping jungle and sent clouds of birds into the air. Almost immediately, the El Pozo battery followed suit, and Roosevelt and Wood became conscious of a white plume of gun smoke hanging motionless over their heads. Wood barely had time to say he wished our brigade could be moved somewhere else when there was a whistling rush from the direction of San Juan Hill, and something exploded in the midst of the white plume. Another shell, another, and another. The second explosion raised a shrapnel bump on Roosevelt's wrist, wounded four Rough Riders, and blew the leg off a regular. The fourth killed and maimed a good many Cubans and perforated the lungs of Wood's horse. Evidently, Spanish gunners were as deadly accurate as Spanish riflemen. Roosevelt waited no longer and hustled his regiment downhill into jungle cover. About 8:45, the enemy cannonade ceased for no apparent reason. Tortilla time? And General Sumner ordered the cavalry division to hurry en masse along Camino Real toward San Juan. About where the jungle thinned out, a creek, also called San Juan, crossed the road at right angles. Here, the Rough Riders were to deploy to the right and await further orders before moving up the heights. Shafter's original battle plan had been for them to link up with the 1st Infantry as soon as General Lawton returned in triumph from El Kanai. But the continual booming of guns from that quarter indicated that the fort was holding up much better than anticipated. For strategic purposes, Lawton's aid could now be discounted. The freshness of the early morning had long since evaporated when Roosevelt, riding on Texas, led his men up the road. But last night's mud was still thick, and the jungle gave off insufferable clouds of dank moisture. The heat rose steadily to 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and the sun drilled down with blistering force on sweaty arms and shoulders. Roosevelt's neck, at least, was protected. He had ingeniously attached his blue polka-dot scarf, the unofficial insignia of a Rough Rider, in a semicircular screen dangling from the rim of his sombrero. It fluttered bravely as he trotted along, like the plumes of Alexander the Great. Later in the day, it would serve him to flamboyant effect. By now, the familiar zzzzoo of Mauser bullets could be heard overhead. They sang louder and louder, in a steady, deathly static, as Kent's 1st Regular Brigade, marching just ahead of Roosevelt, approached San Juan Creek. The trees thinned, and suddenly so many thousands of bullets came down, ripping in sheets through grass and reeds and human bodies, that the mud of the crossing turned red, and the water flowing over it ran purple. The Rough Riders wavered, then halted, horrified at the pileup of bodies in front of them. Ever afterward, this point of deploy was known as Bloody Ford. As if to improve still further the marksmanship of the Spanish snipers, many of whom were hidden in the high crests of royal palms, completely camouflaged with green uniforms and smokeless powder, an irresistible target was towed down Camino Real, the observation balloon of the Signal Corps. Glistening and wobbling in the sun, it stayed aloft long enough to reconnoiter another crossing 500 yards to the left, relieving the gruesome bottleneck at Bloody Ford, and gave the cannons on San Juan Heights a precise indication of the position of the advance column. Plunging frantically across the creek, before the riddled balloon sank and smothered them, the Rough Riders found themselves crouching in a field full of waist-high grass. San Juan Hill rose up directly ahead, its blockhouse and breastworks clearly visible, as were the conical straw hats of entrenched soldiers. Roosevelt's orders were to march to the right, along the bank of the creek, and establish himself at the foot of the little hill that Shafter had overlooked the day before. He, however, had not, and saw at once that it represented the nearest and most dangerous holdout of the enemy. Already it was breathing fire at its crest, like a miniature volcano about to erupt, and spitting showers of Mausers. The bullets came whisking through the grass with vicious effectiveness as the Rough Riders crawled nearer. Every now and again, a trooper would leap involuntarily into the air, then crumple into a nerveless heap. Roosevelt remained obstinately on horseback, determined to set an example of courage to his men. Now began the worst part of the battle. While the Rough Riders took what cover they could, in bushes and banks below the hill, and in the mosquito bogs at the edge of the creek, other cavalry regiments fought their way slowly into specified positions to left and right, and humiliatingly in front of them. The truth was that Roosevelt and his men were being held in reserve by General Sumner, and the new colonel did not like it one bit. The 1st, 3rd, 6th, and even the Black 9th had prior claim to this hill, while General Kent's infantry division was awarded the supreme prize of San Juan Hill, now half a mile away on the left front. Orders were orders. Roosevelt could only scrawl an angry note to the very senior colonel of his immediate neighbors, the 10th Cavalry.
There is too much firing. Colonel Wood directs that there be no more shooting unless there is an advance.
It is doubtful Wood said any such thing. Mere spleen could not last through the 1.5 hours of military torture that followed. General Sumner was waiting for orders to advance from General Shafter, but General Shafter assumed that any damn fool capable of leading a division would know when to do so without authority. Until this slight misunderstanding was cleared up, the cavalry regiments had to lie in stifling heat and try to stop as few Mausers as possible. Morale sagged as the shrieking projectiles chugged into groins, hearts, lungs, limbs, and eyes. Even Roosevelt found it prudent, in this killing hailstorm, to get off his horse and lie low. But Bucky O'Neill insisted on strolling up and down in front of his troop, smoking his perpetual cigarette as if he were still walking along the sidewalk in Prescott, Arizona.
"Sergeant," he said to a protester, "the Spanish bullet isn't made that will kill me."
He had hardly exhaled a laughing cloud of smoke before a Mauser shot went zzzoo into his mouth and burst out the back of his head. The biggest, handsomest, laziest officer in the regiment was dead by the time he hit the ground. It was now well past noon, and the insect-like figures of General Kent's infantry could be seen beginning a slow, toiling ascent of San Juan Hill. Roosevelt sent messenger after messenger to General Sumner, imploring permission to attack his own hill, and was just about to do so unilaterally when the welcome message arrived: "Move forward and support the regulars in the assault on the hills in front." It was not the total advancement he had been hoping for, but it was enough.
"The instant I received the order, I sprang on my horse, and then my crowded hour began."
Soldiers are apt to recollect their wartime actions, as poets do emotions, in tranquility, imposing order and reason upon a dreamlike tumult. Roosevelt was honest enough to admit, even when minutely describing his charge up the hill, that at the time he was aware of very little that was going on outside the orbit of his ears and sweat-fogged spectacles. It was as if some primeval force drove him.
"All men who feel any power of joy in battle," he wrote, "know what it is like when the wolf rises in the heart."
Yet enough original images, visual and auditory, survive in Roosevelt's written account of the battle to give a sense of the rush, the roar, the pounce of that vulpine movement. To begin with, there was the sound of his own voice rasping and swearing as he cajoled terrified soldiers to follow him.
"Are you afraid to stand up when I am on horseback?"
Then the sight of a Rough Rider at his feet being drilled lengthwise with a bullet intended for himself. Next, line after line of cavalry parting before his advance, like waves under a Viking's prow. The puzzled face of a captain refusing to go farther without permission from some senior colonel, who could not be found. Roosevelt.
"Then I am the ranking officer here, and I give the order to charge."
Another refusal. Roosevelt.
"Then let my men through, sir."
Grinning white faces behind him. Black men throwing down a barbed wire fence before him. A wave of his hat and flapping blue neckerchief. The sound of shouting and cheering. The sound of bullets, like the ripping of a silk dress. Little Texas splashing bravely across a stream, galloping on and on, up, up, up. Another wire fence 40 yards from the top, stopping her in her tracks. A bullet grazing his elbow, jumping off, wriggling through and running. Spaniards fleeing from the hacienda above. Only one man with him now, his orderly, Bardshar, shooting and killing two of the enemy. And then suddenly, a revolver salvaged from the main, leaping into his own hand and firing. A Spaniard not 10 yards away doubling over, neatly as a jackrabbit. At last the summit of the hill, his and Bardshar's alone for one breathless moment before the other Rough Riders and cavalrymen swarmed up to join them. One final incongruous image. A huge iron kettle or something of the kind, probably used for sugar refining. As his head cleared and his lungs stopped heaving, Roosevelt found that Kettle Hill commanded an excellent view of Kent's attack on San Juan Hill, still in progress across the valley about 700 yards away. The toiling figures seemed pitifully few. Obviously, the proper thing to do was help them. For the next 10 minutes, he supervised a continuous volley fire at the heads of Spaniards in the San Juan blockhouse, until powerful Gatlings took over from somewhere down below, and the infantry on the left began their final rush. At this, the wolf rose again in Roosevelt's heart. Leaping over rolls of wire, he started down the hill to join them, but forgot to give the order to follow, and found that he had only 5 companions. 2 were shot down while he ran back and roared imprecations at his regiment.
"What are you, cowards? We're waiting for the command. Forward march!"
The Rough Riders willingly obeyed, as well as members of the 1st and 10th Cavalry. Again, Roosevelt pounded over lower ground under heavy fire. Again, he surged up grassy slopes, and again he saw Spaniards deserting their high fortifications. To left and right, all along the crested line of San Juan Heights, other regiments were doing the same.
"When we reached these crests, we found ourselves overlooking Santiago."
Until night fell, Roosevelt was more interested in looking at the carnage behind him than ahead at the prize city. The trenches were filled with corpses in light blue and white uniforms, most of them with little holes in their heads from which their brains were oozing, proof of the killing accuracy of Rough Rider volleys from the top of Kettle Hill.
"Look at all these damned Spanish dead," he exulted to Trooper Bob Ferguson,
an old family friend. Official tallies revealed a fair score of American casualties, 656 according to one count, 1,071 according to another. The Rough Riders contributed 89, but this only increased Roosevelt's sense of pride. He noted that it was the heaviest loss suffered by any regiment in the cavalry division. "No hunting trip so far has ever equaled it in Theodore's eyes," Bob Ferguson wrote to Edith. "It makes up for the omissions of many past years. T was just reveling in victory and gore." Roosevelt's exhilaration at finding himself a hero, already there was talk of a Medal of Honor, and, by virtue of his 2 charges, senior officer in command of the highest crest and extreme front of the American line, was so great that he could not sit, let alone lie down, even in the midst of a surprise bombardment at 3 a.m. A shell landed right next to him, besmirching his skin with powder and killing several nearby soldiers. But he continued to strut up and down, snuffing the fragrant air of combat, silhouetted against the flares like a black lion rampant.
"I really believe firmly now they can't kill him," wrote Ferguson.
So began the Siege of Santiago.
It was not accomplished without considerable further bloodshed, for the Spanish were found to have retreated only half a mile, albeit downhill, and their retaliatory shells did much damage during the next few days. The city proper was stiffly fortified, with 5,000 troops and a seemingly inexhaustible stock of heavy ammunition. Meanwhile, the thin blue and khaki line cresting San Juan Heights grew thinner as wounds, malarial fever, and dysentery reduced more and more men to shivering incapacity and often death. It took less than 48 hours for Roosevelt to become desperate should Shafter decide to withdraw for lack of personnel and supplies. Siboney was still clogged with unlisted crates, and each day's rain made it more difficult to haul wagons along the Camino Real.
"Tell the President, for heaven's sake, to send us every regiment and, above all, every battery possible," he scribbled to Henry Cabot Lodge. "We are within measurable distance of a terrible military disaster."
On the same day, Shafter, blustering out of sheer panic, sent a warning to General Jose Toral of the city garrison.
"I shall be obliged, unless you surrender, to shell Santiago de Cuba. Please inform the citizens of foreign countries, and all women and children, that they should leave the city before 10 o'clock tomorrow morning."
Toral's response was to admit a further 3,600 Spanish troops, who had somehow managed to elude a watch force of insurrectos to the north of the city. That afternoon, while the U.S. Army sweated and sickened in its muddy trenches along the heights, hostilities suddenly broke out in Santiago Harbor. Admiral Cervera's imprisoned ironclads attempted to rush Admiral Sampson's blockade, with suicidal results. By 10 p.m., Shafter was able to inform Washington,
"The Spanish fleet is reported practically destroyed."
He promptly demanded surrender of the city. Toral replied that a truce might be possible. There followed a week of uneasy ceasefire as delicate negotiations went on, designed to ensure the capitulation of Santiago at no harm to Spanish honor. On 4 July, bands along the heights tried to enliven matters with a selection of patriotic tunes, the Rough Riders ensemble contributing Fair Harvard. But the music had no charms for men sitting in mud, and it soon died away on the still morning air. General Toral's dignity was saved by an ingenious compromise worked out on 15 July. The Santiago garrison would surrender in 2 days if His Excellency, the Commander-in-Chief of the American forces, would kindly bombard the city, shooting at a safe height above the houses, until all Spanish soldiers had handed in their arms. They might thus be truthfully said to have capitulated under fire. That night, the air shook convincingly all over Santiago, and on Sunday, 17 July, the Stars and Stripes was hauled up the palace flagpole, just as church bells rang in the hour of noon. It was time for Spain to begin her withdrawal from Cuba, after 4 centuries of imperial dominion in the New World. But first, lunch, wine, and siesta. On Monday, 18 July, Colonel Theodore Roosevelt, the title was official now, marched with the cavalry division over San Juan Hill to a camping ground on the foothills west of El Cañay. The move away from the stinking, mosquito-filled trenches was deemed essential because of yellow fever. Already, more than half the Rough Riders were, in Roosevelt's words, dead or disabled by wounds and sickness. But the mosquitoes inland were just as poisonous as those nearer the coast, and his sick list lengthened. Although mildly diverted by the curious fact that the colored troops seemed to suffer as heavily as the white, he did not leave the problem to medics or the commissariat. His men must eat and build up their strength for another possible campaign in Puerto Rico. Accordingly, he sent a pack train into Santiago with instructions to buy, at his expense, whatever simple delicacies they could find to supplement the nauseating rations in camp. One Rough Rider claimed that Roosevelt spent $5,000 in personal funds during the next few weeks, an exaggeration, no doubt, but it at least indicates the extent of his generosity and concern. As for himself, he remained healthy and strong as ever, so much so that he proposed to swim in the Caribbean one day with Lieutenant Jack Greenway. The two officers had been invited to Morro Castle by General Fitzhugh Lee, and Roosevelt's attention was drawn to the wreck of the Merrimack, some 300 yards out to sea. It would be fun, he said, pulling off his clothes, to go out and inspect her. What a colonel suggested, a lieutenant was bound to obey, and Greenway reluctantly agreed to accompany Roosevelt into the water. We weren't out more than a dozen strokes before Lee, who had clambered up on the parapet of Fort Morro, began to yell.
"Can you make out what he's trying to say?"
the old man asked, punctuating his words with long overhand strokes.
"Sharks," says I, wishing I were back on shore.
"Sharks," says the colonel, blowing out a mouthful of water.
"They,"
stroke,
"won't,"
stroke,
"bite,"
stroke.
"I've been,"
stroke,
"studying them,"
stroke,
"all my life,"
stroke,
"and I never,"
stroke,
"heard of one,"
stroke,
"bothering a swimmer,"
stroke.
"It's all,"
stroke,
"poppycock."
Just then a big fellow, probably not more than 10 or 12 feet long, but looking as big as a battleship to me, showed up alongside us. Then came another, till we had quite a group. The colonel didn't pay the least attention. Meanwhile, the old general was doing a war dance up on the parapet, shouting and standing first on one foot and then on the other, and working his arms like he was doing something on a bet. Finally, we reached the wreck, and I felt better. The colonel, of course, got busy looking things over. I had to pretend I was interested, but I was thinking of the sharks and getting back to shore. I didn't hurry the colonel in his inspection, either. After a while, he had seen enough, and we went over the side again. Soon the sharks were all about us again, sort of pacing us in, as they had paced us out, while the old general did the second part of his war dance. He felt a whole lot better when we landed. And so did I. On 20 July, Roosevelt found himself in command of the whole 2nd Brigade. This elevation was due to medical attrition in the higher ranks, rather than his heroism at San Juan, but it was flattering nevertheless. So, too, was the growing flood of letters and telegrams from New York, urging him to consider running for the governorship in the fall. He replied politely that he would not think of quitting his present position, even for so great an office, at least not while the war is on. With preparations for a peace treaty already well underway, the implication of acceptance was obvious, and plots were laid by various Republican groups to entrap him the moment he stepped ashore in the United States. At this point, Roosevelt's old genius for political publicity reasserted itself. On or about the last day of July, General Shafter called a conference of all division and brigade commanders to discuss the health situation. All agreed that it was critical, and that the War Department's apparent unwillingness to evacuate the army was inexcusable. Somebody must write a formal letter stating that in the unanimous opinion of the 5th Corps staff, a further stay in Cuba would be to the absolute and objectless ruin of the fighting forces. Having reached this agreement, the regular officers hesitated. None wished to sacrifice his career by offending Secretary Alger or President McKinley. As the conference's junior officer and a volunteer, Roosevelt was nudged, or more probably leaped, into the breach. The result was a round-robin letter drafted by himself and signed by all present, dated 3 August 1898, and handed to the Associated Press. "We, the undersigned officers, are of the unanimous opinion that this army should be at once taken out of the island of Cuba and sent to some point on the northern seacoast of the United States, that the army is disabled by malarial fever to the extent that its efficiency is destroyed, and that it is in a condition to be practically entirely destroyed by an epidemic of yellow fever, which is sure to come in the near future. This army must be moved at once or perish. As the army can be safely moved now, the persons responsible for preventing such a move will be responsible for the unnecessary loss of many thousands of lives." The document, accompanied by a long and even stronger letter of complaint signed by Roosevelt alone, was published next morning. As predicted, Secretary Alger was enraged. So, too, was the president, whose first inkling of the round-robin came when he opened his morning papers. There were muttered threats in the War Department of court-martialing Roosevelt. Alger vengefully published an earlier letter from Roosevelt to himself, bragging that the Rough Riders are as good as any regulars and three times as good as any state troops. This was a telling blow to any aspiring governor of New York State. An instant storm of criticism blew up in the press. The Journal accused Roosevelt of irresistible self-assertion and egotism, ill-suited to his really admirable services in the field. The Philadelphia Press remarked that in view of intense indignation among the militia, it was unlikely that the New York Republican Party could now nominate Theodore Roosevelt for governor. But many newspapers found equal fault with Secretary Alger and charged him with treachery in publishing a private letter. "The colonel could surely be excused his overweening pride in his regiment," commented the Baltimore American. "After all, he led these men in one of the noblest fights of the century."
Within 3 days, Shafter's army was ordered to Montauk, Long Island. The Rough Riders sailed out of Santiago Harbor on 8 August, leaving Leonard Wood behind as military governor of the city. They were not sorry to see Cuba sink into the sea behind them. In 7 weeks of sweaty, sickly acquaintance with it, they had seen it transformed from a tropical Garden of Eden to a hell of denuded trees, cindery fields, and staring shells of houses. The island's bugs were in their veins, the smell of its dead in their nostrils, the taste of its horse meat and fecal water in their mouths. It would be days before the Atlantic breezes, cooling and freshening as they steamed north, swept away this sense of defilement. Yet the farther Cuba dropped away, the brighter shone the memory of their two great battles, in particular that rush up Kettle Hill behind the man with the flying blue neckerchief. They had done something which orthodox military strategists considered impossible, namely, stormed and captured a higher redoubt over open ground, using weapons inferior to and fewer than those of a securely entrenched enemy. In doing so, they had been the first to break the Spanish defenses. Charging on, they had been first to take and hold the final crest overlooking Santiago. For Roosevelt himself, the crowded hour atop San Juan Heights had been one of absolute fulfillment. "I would rather have led that charge than served 3 terms in the U.S. Senate." And he would rather die from yellow fever as a result than never to have charged at all. "Should the worst come to the worst, I am quite content to go now and to leave my children at least an honorable name," he told Henry Cabot Lodge. "And, old man, if I do go, I do wish you would get that Medal of Honor for me anyhow, as I should awfully like the children to have it, and I think I earned it." With fulfillment came purgation. Bellicose poisons had been breeding in him since infancy. During recent years the strain had grown virulent, clouding his mind and souring the natural sweetness of his temperament. But at last he had his bloodletting. He had fought a war and killed a man. He had driven the Spaniard from the New World. Theodore Roosevelt was at last, incongruously but wholeheartedly, a man of peace. Chapter 26. The Most Famous Man in America. From the contending crowd a shout, a mingled sound of triumph and of wailing. It was Monday, 15 August, 1898. All morning the crowd scattered across the sands of Montauk Point grew larger, as the troop ship Miami wallowed at anchor 3 miles out to sea. Soldiers and civilians, women and children, reporters and Red Cross staff, squinted over the water, wondering when the Rough Riders would be allowed to disembark. While they waited, a westerly breeze snapped the sails of yachts in the harbor and swished through the pines of Wythe-marred Headland. It was this prevailing wind that had determined the selection of Montauk Point as the mustering-out camp for General Shafter's army. Presumably it would blow away whatever yellow fever bacilli lingered among the troops, wafting them somewhere in the direction of Spain. Not until nearly noon did the tugs bring Miami in and nudge her sideways against the pier. The crowd peered eagerly at the deep rows of soldiers on board, searching in vain for a hero to recognize. Presently, 2 spectacle lenses flashed like prisms at the end of the bridge, and a big bronzed-faced man in a light brown uniform was seen waving his campaign hat. 100 voices delightedly roared, "Roosevelt! Roosevelt! Hurrah for Teddy and the Rough Riders!" Beside him, somebody made out a whiskery little general in blue. "Hurrah for Fighting Joe!" While sailors made the ship fast, an officer on the pier shouted, "How are you, Colonel Roosevelt?" The reply came back in a voice audible 1/2 mile away. "I am feeling disgracefully well." There was a pause while Roosevelt allowed the crowd to study the dozens of emaciated faces elsewhere on deck. "I feel positively ashamed of my appearance," he went on, "when I see how badly off some of my brave fellows are." Another pause. Then, "Oh, but we have had a bully fight!" Laughter and cheers spread from ship to shore and back again. 1/4 hour later, General Wheeler stepped onto the soil of Long Island, toting a Spanish sword so long and heavy its scabbard dragged on the ground. He received a tumultuous welcome, but, to quote Edward Marshall, "When Teddy and his teeth came down the gangplank, the last ultimate climax of the possibility of cheering was reached." Roosevelt's appearance at close range showed that his claims of rude health were not exaggerated. 3 months of hunger, thirst, heat, mud, and execrable food, not to mention that most arduous of human activities, infantry fighting, had not thinned him. If anything, he looked thicker and stronger than when he entrained for San Antonio. He wore a fresh uniform with gaiters and scuffed boots. A cartridge belt encircled his waist, and a heavy revolver thumped against his hip as he fairly ran the last few steps onto the dock. Roosevelt was courteous to the official welcoming party, doffing his hat and bowing to the women on line. But out of the corner of his eye he caught sight of a group of newspapermen and soon made his way over to them.
"Will you be our next governor?" a voice cried.
"None of that. All I'll talk about is the regiment. It's the finest regiment that ever was, and I'm proud to command it."
While he talked, the Rough Riders were disembarking. To the horror and sympathy of the crowd, they appeared barely able to line up on the dock, let alone march over the hill to Camp Wyckoff, a mile or so inland. Their ranks were pitifully decimated.
"My God," said one witness, "there are not half of the men there that left."
Roosevelt was enjoying his conversation with the press so much that he paid little attention to the movement of soldiers behind him. His face radiated happiness as he described the feats of the Army's Crackerjack Regiment and of himself as its colonel.
"This is a pistol with a history," he said, fondling his revolver affectionately. "It was taken from the wreck of the Maine. When I took it to Cuba, I made a vow to kill at least one Spaniard with it, and I did."
Well might he be happy. Theodore Roosevelt had come home to find himself the most famous man in America, more famous even than Dewey, whose victory at Manila had been eclipsed, if temporarily, by the successive glories of Las Guasimas, San Juan, Santiago, and the Round Robin which brought our boys back home. The news that the United States and Spain had just signed a peace initiative came as a crowning satisfaction. Intent as Roosevelt might be to parry questions about his gubernatorial ambitions, thereby strengthening rumors that he had already decided to run, his days as a soldier were numbered. It remained only to spend 5 days in quarantine and a few weeks supervising the demobilization of his regiment, before returning to civilian life and claiming the superb inheritance he had earned in Cuba. Shortly before 2 o'clock, the colonel strode onto the beach where the cavalry division had formed in double file and mounted a horse beside General Wheeler. Color Sergeant Wright hoisted the ragged regimental flag, the band crashed out a march, and the Rough Riders trooped off to detention. Meanwhile, at the opposite end of Long Island, the man whose power it was to nominate or not to nominate Roosevelt for governor sat pondering the state political situation. Senator Thomas Collier Platt was taking his annual vacation at the Oriental Hotel on Sheepshead Bay. He had been aware since at least 20 July that various groups of Republicans were working up a Roosevelt boom, but not until yesterday, 14 August, had two trusted lieutenants approached him formally on the subject. These men were Lemuel Eli Quigg, Roosevelt's backer for mayor in 1894, and Benjamin B. O'Dell, Jr., chairman of the Republican State Committee. Since Quigg was, in turn, chairman of the New York County Committee, and as forceful as O'Dell was stubborn, Platt had no choice but to listen while they pleaded the cause of the man he still regarded as a perfect bull in a china shop. The easy boss knew that something drastic would have to be done to prevent the renomination at the state Republican convention in September of Frank S. Black, New York's present governor. Black was a faithful protege whose record victory in 1896 had covered Platt with glory. But he was also anathema to Republican independents, who accused him, rather unjustly, of gross spoilsmanship in office. This negative reputation might be counterbalanced by positive support for Black in upstate rural areas, were it not for a new scandal which redounded to the governor's discredit. On 4 August, a special investigative committee had reported on improper expenditures of at least $1 million in the state's stalled Erie Canal Improvement Project. With the entire multi-million-dollar appropriation already spent, and less than 2/3 of the canal deepened, Platt was severely embarrassed. If he supported Black's bid for re-election, he would lay himself and the party open to charges of cynicism and irresponsibility, even though the governor had not been personally involved in the scandal. If, on the other hand, Platt dropped Black, it would be tantamount to admitting that there had been high-level corruption.
Platt weighed his alternatives and chose the second, seeing it as the only way he might avoid a Democratic landslide in November. He agreed to let Quigg sound Roosevelt out, but made it clear that the Rough Rider was not his preference for the nomination.
"If he becomes governor of New York, sooner or later, with his personality, he will have to be president of the United States. I am afraid to start that thing going."
Quigg, however, was not the first kingmaker to visit Roosevelt at Montauk. On Thursday, 18 August, John J. Chapman, one of the Independent Party's fiercest and brightest idealists, walked up Camp Wyckoff's Rough Rider Street in search of the colonel. Tall, hook-nosed, flamboyantly scarfed even in the hottest weather, Chapman was a man of near manic passions, both romantic and intellectual. As testimony to the former, he would brandish the stump of a missing left hand, which he had deliberately burned to a cinder as self-punishment during a stormy love affair. Like Theodore Roosevelt, his friend of many years, he was well-born, Harvard-educated, and drawn equally to politics and literature. His Emerson and other essays had won the high praises of Henry James. But there the resemblance ended. Chapman could neither compromise, nor join, nor lead. He was a savage loner, fated to work outside the party, a thinker whose pure ideology was unsmirched by practical considerations. Normally, Roosevelt despised such people, but Chapman, 4 years his junior, had such courage and charm as to be permitted the supreme familiarity of Teddy. It so happened that in August 1898, Chapman was for the first and only time in his life on the verge of real political power, if he could only persuade Roosevelt to run for governor on an independent ticket. The colonel's popularity, he reasoned, was so great as to seduce large numbers of Republican voters and would force Boss Platt to nominate him as well, in order to keep those voters within the party. Roosevelt would thus head two tickets, followed on the one by a list of decent young independents, and on the other by machine Republicans. The majority of the electorate, given such a choice, would surely prefer to send Roosevelt to Albany in virtuous company. It was a beautiful plan, at least in Chapman's enthusiastic opinion. Roosevelt would be almost assured the governorship, with all voters who were not Democrats united in his favor. The independents would at one stroke broaden their narrow power base, at present confined largely to the Citizens Union and good government clubs in New York City, to encompass the whole state. And most important of all, Boss Platt's machine would be destroyed. Chapman was so sure of himself he allowed Roosevelt a week to think it over. The colonel, who had everything to gain as a gubernatorial prospect by remaining silent, accepted this offer with the equanimity of one of his favorite fictional characters, Uncle Remus's tar baby. The following day, Lemuel Quigg arrived. Sleek, suave, prematurely gray on either side of his center parting, he made a noticeable contrast to his independent rival. Yet the language he spoke was equally sweet to Roosevelt's ears. Quigg earnestly hoped to see the colonel nominated, and believed that the great body of Republican voters so desired. He and Odell were pestering Senator Platt to that effect, but before they pestered further, they would have to have a plain statement as to whether or not Roosevelt wanted the nomination. Roosevelt said that he did, but in view of the fact that Quigg had made no formal offer, this should not be considered a formal reply. He promised, nevertheless, that once in power he would not make war on Mr. Platt or anybody else if war could be avoided. As a Republican governor, he would naturally work with the Republican machine in the sincere hope that there might always result harmony of opinion and purpose. He reserved the right, however, to consult with whom he pleased and act finally as my own judgment and conscience dictated. Quigg replied that he had expected just such an answer and would transmit it to Senator Platt. Having thus authorized two secret nomination campaigns and given tacit approval to the manufacture of 10,000 "Our Teddy for Our Governor" buttons, Roosevelt was free to leave Camp Wyckoff on 20 August for a 5-day reunion with his family. He smilingly refused to discuss his future with reporters.
"Now stop it. I will not say a word about myself, but I will talk about the regiment forever."
As a result of this strategy, he kept himself in the headlines, while avoiding all political complications. "He is playing the game of a pretty foxy man," said a worried Democratic campaign official. His trip to Oyster Bay was carefully timed to coincide with the Republican State Committee meeting in Manhattan. This pre-convention assemblage enabled Senator Platt to weigh the relative strengths of Black, Roosevelt, and other potential candidates for the nomination. According to Quigg, the easy boss was impressed by reports of Roosevelt enthusiasm